Toby Young left London for New York in 1995. He had an ace in his pocket, a job as contributing editor at Vanity Fair magazine, working for Power editor-in-chief Graydon Carter. He was poised to take Manhattan. Then, it all went spectacularly wrong. There is a silver lining. Young wrote a memoir about his experience called How to Lose Friends and Alienate People. It was such a hit, it's been adapted to a play by the same name. Here's a clip.
Popular culture was my religion, and Hollywood was my mecca. Being at the Vanity Fair Oscar party was like attending a rally of fellow believers. I felt like I'd arrived. I was among my own people at last.
Young told Steve Paulson that his obsession with celebrity led to one of his most humiliating experiences, the Vanity Fair Oscar party in L.A.
I managed to snag myself an 11:45 invite, even though the party officially ended at midnight. And the way I did that was by selling a piece to an English paper about the party. So I had to be there to write about it, and Vanity Fair was going to get some coverage in the UK. But at the last minute, having successfully negotiated my way through these various hoops, I got a call from the director of public relations at Vanity Fair telling me that unfortunately my name had been taken off the list. They just couldn't accommodate me. The LA fire marshals were clamping down on numbers. It was totally out of our hands. And this is an age-old excuse, the LA fire marshals, the party organizers in Los Angeles use to disinvite people all the time. And a friend of mine who'd also traveled out to Los Angeles to cover the party too, who hadn't been able to get an invitation up until that point, got a call almost immediately after my call inviting him to the party at 11:45. So he'd effectively been given my slot. I decided, you know, I haven't come all this way only to kind of collapse at the final fence. So I got to the party at sort of like 22:12 and managed to pass myself off as my friend. And he arrived 5 minutes later. And as soon as the clipboard Nazis realized their mistake, I was then ejected from the party.
But you did actually manage to get in for a few minutes, didn't you?
I did actually manage to get in for a few minutes, yes.
So did you actually talk to any movie stars when you were there?
Yeah, I managed to talk to an English actress called Amanda de Cadenet. And I told her that if there was an Oscar for the best supporting dress, she would have won because she was wearing this kind of fabulous kind of piece of advanced aeronautical engineering, which managed to kind of prop her up in all the right places. And she took enormous umbrage at that and stalked off. And I then approached Kenneth Branagh. And my opening gambit with him was, you know, how many unlettered Hollywood execs have come up to you this evening and said, "I just loved you in that Shakespeare thing." And he misheard me, thought that I was kind of an unlettered exec trying to compliment him, and said, "Which Shakespeare thing would that be?" And I then couldn't think of any of the Shakespeare things he'd actually done. I was like, Hamlet? Nope, that was Mel Gibson. Prospero's books? Nope, John Gielgud. And he was like, "Goodbye." It wasn't a successful encounter.
And then you got tossed out after that.
And then I got tossed out, yeah.
It sounds kind of humiliating, the whole thing.
It was humiliating, there's no question about it. But I did feel an immense source of pride on having managed to gatecrash the party. It is, you know, the hardest party to gatecrash in the world, harder even, I think, than the presidential inauguration. The only other journalist to successfully gatecrash the Vanity Fair Oscar party was a reporter for the Star, the supermarket tabloid, who showed up in 96 with a pig on a leash. And the pig had a little bow tie and a tuxedo on. And the reporter managed to pass the pig off as the Star of Babe, which was one of that year's Oscar nominees, even though 20 pigs, you know, actually took turns to play that role, and sailed on into the party.
So I suppose the perfect job for you then would be to actually land a gig at Vanity Fair, the magazine.
Absolutely. And that is what happened a year later. I got the call from Graydon Carter, the editor-in-chief, who invited me to come out for a month. And a month turned into 3 months, 3 months into six, and I ended up staying at the magazine for almost 3 years.
What was Graydon Carter like?
He was actually the closest person I ever came, I think, in New York to a kind of star of a Hollywood screwball comedy. I mean, I absolutely adore films like His Girl Friday, It Happened One Night, and I was expecting to find, you know, these kind of Clark Gable, Cary Grant, Rosalind Russell-like figures in the New York newspaper and magazine business. This is how I imagined journalists in New York to be. And, of course, they weren't a bit like that, with the exception of Graydon. I remember first time I met him, I tried to sell him on the idea of a photographic portfolio in the magazine of literary London, featuring kind of distinguished British authors in their favorite pubs, you know, headshots. And he was like, what, are you kidding? It looked like a dental textbook. I thought that was a great line, and he you know, he came up with a series of great one-liners, very much along those lines. If I pitched him with an idea he didn't like, he'd say, "It's a dog whistle, Toby. You can hear it. I can't."
Well, but, I got the impression that he wanted to make sure you weren't going to get too uppity either. He had this this whole hierarchical scheme of how things worked at Vanity Fair, and you had only gotten into the first room.
That's right. Shortly after I arrived, he gave me what I subsequently learnt was called his seven rooms speech, which went like this. Toby, you're running the big bucks. You got an office on Madison Avenue. You think you're the cat's pajamas. But let me tell you something. You're in the first room. After 3 months, maybe 6 months, you'll discover a discreet doorway back of the first room leads to the second. There are seven rooms in total. I'm in the seventh. You're in the first. And don't you forget it.
And his other way. And who occupied the middle five rooms?
I'm not sure. I think various kind of editors, perhaps at Vanity Fair, were kind of gradually making their way through the rooms. And I sort of got the impression that the seventh room was so small that only Graydon could fit in it. And he was in there kind of guarding the entranceway fanatically, seeing off all comers.
So what did you actually do at Vanity Fair?
Well, not a great deal. When I was eventually let go about 3 years later, Graydon sat me down and said that he divided the amount he paid me by the number of words of mine that had actually appeared in the pages of Vanity Fair and concluded that I was the highest paid writer in the magazine's history.
Now, you also write about some interviews that you actually did that did not go terribly well, especially one with the actor Nathan Lane.
Yeah, well, I was eventually given an assignment, which was to go off and interview Nathan Lane. And in Graydon's words, this assignment was idiot-proof. You know, he's such a gifted raconteur. All I had to do was switch the tape recorder on, say nothing, turn it off, walk out, and transcribe what he said. But stupidly, I thought I'd try and make something of this opportunity. And I looked through the clippings beforehand and, to my amazement, discovered that he'd never actually been asked straight out whether he was gay or not. And that struck me as peculiar because, you know, he always plays gay roles. The reason I was doing him for Vanity Fair is because he was about to come out in The Birdcage, in which he plays Robin Williams's boyfriend. So I thought, well, I'll ask him about this. So I go along to the interview. His publicist is kind of hovering in the background, kind of keeping an eye on things. And I kick off saying, just got to get a few basic biographical facts straight, Mr. Lane. Am I right in thinking you're Jewish? And, you know, he looked extremely put out. He said, yes, yes, what of it? Move on, next question. And I thought, well, if you didn't like that one, you're probably not going to like the next one much. You know, Mr. Lane, you've often played gay characters. You even did the voiceover for Timon in The Lion King, generally considered Disney's campest ever animated character. Are you gay? And his jaw hit the floor. And when he'd recovered his composure, he just got up and walked away. And a few minutes later, his publicist came over and said, would you please leave? You're making Mr. Lane uncomfortable. I'm like, leave? But I haven't interviewed him yet. Said, the interview's over. You're going to have to leave right now. And so I went back to the office. By the time I got there, she had called Graydon. He hauled me into his office and said, Toby, what were you thinking? You can't ask Hollywood celebrities whether they're Jewish or gay. In future, just assume they're all Jewish and all gay, okay?
And did you take that advice?
Well, there was no future. I was never given another celebrity to interview, not surprisingly.
Oh, really? So that was your first and last, in a way?
More or less my only other celebrity encounter in my capacity as a journalist for Vanity Fair was at the 1996 Vanity Fair Oscar party. Again, I'd managed to snag myself an 11:45 invitation. This time, my name was actually on the list. So I was sitting at the bar nursing a Black Label on the Rocks when Mel Gibson walks in, and he just won 2 Oscars for Braveheart, and he was on the sort of final run of his victory lap of Hollywood. You probably won't know this, but in England, Mel Gibson's a bit of a bête noire because he keeps making these anti-English films. He made Gallipoli, he made Braveheart, which more or less kick-started the Scottish nationalist movement over there, and he went on to make The Patriot, which depicts the English as these kind of child-burning Nazis in the War of Independence. And so I thought, you know, I'll ask him about this. You know, I had a few drinks. I thought, I'll confront him about this. So I walked up to him, tapped him on the shoulder and said, you know, Mr. Gibson, what have you got against the English? And he wheeled round, and it was at that point that I noticed he was clutching the 2 Oscars he'd won in each hand. And he sized me up, realized I was absolutely no threat, transferred the Oscar in his right hand to his left. So he was clutching 2 Oscars in his kind of left paw, like a broadsword, thrust out his right hand and said, "Hoy, I'm Mel Gibson." And yeah, this is celebrity jujitsu. I was totally disarmed. "Oh, hi, I'm David Young." And the next thing I know, I feel this tug on the back of my collar. I'm sent sprawling into the crowd. I look up, and there's Graydon. "Toby, what did I tell you? Stop bothering the celebrities."
Now, was there one precipitating event that actually got you fired from Vanity Fair?
Yeah, it was I got into a bar fight in a bar called Pravda, and I got rather kind of roughed up by the bouncers. And it was reported in Page 6, the gossip column of the New York Post. And when Graydon saw that, he was like, "That's it, Toby. This is not good publicity for the magazine. We don't want our journalists appearing in gossip columns doing this kind of thing. I'm going to have to take your name off the masthead." And yeah, that was the beginning of the end.
So once you lost your job at Vanity Fair, you actually didn't just go back to London right away. You hung out in New York for a while.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't face going back to London with my tail between my legs, having kind of failed to take Manhattan. You know, I'd made quite a to-do about kind of leaving London. I'd had this leaving party. I'd told all my friends, you know, the next time they saw me, I'd be the editor-in-chief of a New York glossy magazine. You know, they'd be lucky if I returned their calls. You know, it was a very arrogant exit. And I sort of imagined this sort of committee of all my friends kind of awaiting my return at Heathrow, ready to kind of point and laugh the moment I walked off the plane. A total fantasy on my part. I mean, in fact, my friends, when I eventually did see them again, you know, were scarcely aware that I'd been away. But, you know, it's kind of a bit like once you've kind of moved from your hometown to the big city, you can't then go back to your hometown. It's just too humiliating. And I subsequently discovered when I went to Los Angeles that there are, in fact, entire neighborhoods full of British people in Los Angeles, and they've achieved nothing. They're like, you know, at best kind of plumbers and kind of, you know, waiters. But they just can't go back to Britain because it's too humiliating. So they're just going to stay out there and rot.
These days, Toby Young is married to the girl of his dreams with a baby on the way. He lives in London. Steve Paulson spoke with him about the memoir, How to Lose Friends and Alienate People.